Welcome to Scholars Speak, a podcast of the Mitchell Institute, in which we catch up with Mitchell scholars far and wide to hear their stories. Thank you for joining me, your host, Mark Glass, Director of Communications at the Mitchell Institute, for today's episode of Scholars Speak. And now let's get to it. Well, welcome to this episode of Scholars Speak. I'm delighted to be joined by today's guest, Ethan Pierce, the 2009 Mitchell Scholar from Gardner Area High School and a graduate of Harvard University. Ethan, welcome to Scholars Speak, and thank you for setting aside time in your busy schedule to talk with us today.
Absolutely, it's a pleasure.
So I believe you hold the distinction of being the first Mitchell Scholar on the podcast who is working in the field of artificial intelligence, as you are the co-founder of Adaptive Reader, which is an AI startup based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Can you start by telling us what Adaptive Reader is and how it works?
Yeah, so I think grounding in the problem, first and foremost. The last company that I was part of, I was on the founding team of a company called Readly, which was also in the literacy space. And I would talk to teachers, and again, I would hear this same thing. Hey, I'm a 10th grade teacher. Some of my kids are reading at a college level. And in the same class, I have kids that are reading at a second grade level. How am I supposed to serve all of those students? And so, you know, what ended up happening is that these teachers would be forced to teach to the middle, which means that maybe they were actually teaching curriculum that was below grade level to try and make it more accessible for some of those struggling students. But they were leaving students behind on either side. And so that seemed like a problem that AI could actually really help with. And so what we started experimenting with last year was, what if we could use large language models? What if we could use AI to take the content these students were supposed to be reading, like The Great Gatsby, and rewrite it at multiple reading levels in multiple languages so that every student could have a version that, not to say that it's easy for them, we want it to be challenging, but we don't want it to be so difficult that they get frustrated and give up and stop trying. So that's what Adaptive Reader has done. We take these classic novels, we've started with novels, we're looking towards textbooks in the future, and we'll rewrite them at multiple reading levels. They're available in paperback, or you can also read them online. And this is an opportunity to bridge that gap for struggling readers. So every student can go home at night, read the book, come to class the next day with an understanding of what's going on, participate in that critical thinking discussion with their peers. And then we always encourage all of our teachers to ground classroom instruction in the original text, because, you know, this isn't about, you know, we've heard some people will ask, wait, is this dumbing down that text? And that's absolutely not what we want to do. We have a deep appreciation for the craft of that and want every student to be exposed to that original language, but coming to class with an understanding of what's going on, a confidence that they can participate, and then have a teacher there who can help them work through that difficult sentence structure and vocabulary that could be really new to them.
That is fascinating. And I can see very clearly how Adaptive Reader is addressing a need. So I wanted to clarify, your clients, are they individual teachers, or do you work with entire school districts?
Great question. So individual teachers can come to adaptivereader.com. We have 12 of our books in place that are actually free online. So educators can dive right in, start using it. They can also order paperbacks, as low as one paperback to a whole classroom set. But we do work with schools and districts as well for digital licensing. So everyone can have access to our whole library of texts.
Let's get to your motivation for developing Adaptive Reader. Did you, for instance, have an experience or a conversation that led you to understand the critical need for a tool that could make challenging works of literature more accessible?
Very much so. I hadn't learned to read at the end of third grade. I was one of those IEP students with that extra instruction. I was pulled out of those classes. I struggled with reading and writing. I failed every spelling test that I ever took, probably still would today, because my brain works a little bit differently than other folks. And that could be really disheartening, right? That can, for a developing student, that can be very hard on their sense of self, especially when we tie this intelligence so closely to our worth. So I continue to sort of struggle in different ways through the middle of middle school, and then had a few teachers who just really paid attention to me. I remember my high school history teacher. She would actually bring me home with a couple of students on Friday nights, make us dinner, and work with us. And you know, this is a different day and age, but they just having the attention of an educator who saw the potential, who could work with us, and that transition from me being a struggling student to getting a full scholarship to Harvard. And I look back at how different my life could have been if I hadn't had those few folks along the way who saw something in me and decided to take that extra time and energy. And so I think the critical thing in my mind, so many kids get to high school reading 2 or more years behind grade level, whether that's from an undiagnosed learning disability or dyslexia. Maybe they're a multi-language learner that has a different language spoken at home. The question is, those kids aren't lost. So how can we support them in really understanding the curriculum, developing those critical thinking skills, not falling further behind, while at the same time they work towards mastering those reading comprehension skills and leveling up?
Ethan, it's my understanding that you were a humanities major at Harvard. I'm wondering if you can tell us how you made the leap from being a humanities major to an innovator and a startup leader in the field of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, I never would have expected it either. I studied art and art history as an undergrad. And it's funny because I actually see the work that we're doing today with Adaptive Reader is really close to that. What I love about art and art history is that art and literature, they're these magical things that they force you to expand how you think about the world. They help you develop as a person. And what I wanted for my career was a way to be able to. I feel like studying art and art history opened my eyes in so many ways to thinking about the world differently or through other people's eyes. And I wanted to share that experience with more people. And I realized that I could have the most impact if I actually went out and worked with technology and developed those skills, to be able to scale the change in a different way.
I suspect that many current Mitchell scholars who are listening, and perhaps even some alumni, might be interested in exploring the possibility of working in the field of artificial intelligence. I'm wondering what advice you might have for people who have an interest in working in AI or would like to explore AI as a possible career field.
Great question. You know, I think the first thing is hopefully like a really easy step, which is go to ChatGPT or to any of the AI models. And I think of it as sort of different levels of usage. So I was actually talking to literally a couple of nuclear physicists over lunch at MIT last week, and neither of them are from the United States. And they were talking about how they were using ChatGPT to help them find spelling and grammar errors in their dissertations. And I asked them, well, have you tried putting your dissertation in there and asking ChatGPT, what are some of the holes in my argument? What are some of the other ways that I could think about this? Or, for example, you have to defend that dissertation to a panel of professors. What are some of the questions that I might ask? And so I always encourage people, beyond just having ChatGPT write an email or draft a resume for you, start playing around with how it can actually help you as a creative partner to, if you are interested in going into AI, for example, start a conversation with it about what those skills might be, what different opportunities there are, and what some of the challenges In my case, you can even ask it that question. What are some of the challenges from where I am today to getting there? And what are some of the opportunities? And like, look at my resume, look at my background. What are the strengths that I can draw from as I look into this field?
That's fascinating. I have never thought of tools like ChatGPT as potential career coaches in some way, but is that getting close to how you see that technology potentially providing assistance to users?
I think the magic of ChatGPT, or Google has its own version, like there are a variety of these large language models that are out there, is it is so dynamic. And there's so many ways that you can leverage it, from a career coach to a business partner that can help you think through with Adaptive Reader, we call it a go-to-market strategy. How do we get this out there? How do we reach teachers? What are the different channels we can use? So it's really multifaceted in that way. And if you go online and just Google, AI career coach, I bet you'll find a bunch of companies that are coming up with different paid solutions that can help you with that. And those are going to be great. But you can start off super easy now for no cost with just starting to ask those questions. And it's about opening your mind to thinking in new ways about what that career could look like and how AI can help you to think more creatively about those next steps.
Ethan, you're a leader in this space. I'm wondering if you can gaze into the crystal ball and forecast out, maybe for us, some things that you're really excited about in the field of AI. What technologies or uses do you see emerging or you'd like to see emerge that you think perhaps have the potential to emerge for people?
Yeah, great question. I think there's a lot of anxiety right now about AI, and there's going to be a lot of change in the next few years. I'd say first and foremost, our job to one another is to help each other to reskill and to adapt to those changes. And I actually think that's going to be the biggest challenge of our generation, and the biggest calling in our generation is to make sure that no one is left behind as that change happens. At the same time, there are some things that I'm really excited about. With what we're doing, we're able to translate first these novels, but soon textbooks into 94 languages. So look at a school like Portland High School that has 53 languages spoken in the classroom. Urdu, Vietnamese, Mandarin, Spanish are four of the most common languages. And so the capacity to provide instruction that helps not only those students, but also their parents who often speak even less English, I should say, are earlier on in their English learning journey than the students to really participate. That's super exciting. But the one that like gets me really excited is actually about telling stories. And I think that there's this fear among artists and writers and creatives right now that AI is going to take the place of people in creating works of art and sharing stories. I think what's happening is telling stories has always had two different aspects, two different pillars. One is craft, and the other is narrative in a way. That's how I like to think about it. And craft has always been this set of skills that you develop very slowly over time. And often you had to go to a very fancy college and develop that vocabulary, develop the craft for this applies to filmmaking or any type of creativity. You had to develop these skills. And people who didn't have that opportunity, they might have stories that are equally compelling. They might have ideas about the world that are just as valid and just as important, but they were limited by the fact that they didn't have that craft skill. And so when they tried to share their story, maybe there were spelling mistakes or grammar mistakes, or the vocabulary appeared unsophisticated. And so readers or viewers would look at that and say, see it as a value signal for that person's intelligence or their worth, and devalue what that person was bringing to the table. The really powerful thing I think that is happening right now is, and somebody put it really well the other day, like AI is sort of raising the boat of craft for everyone. Like I use it to help me when I'm sending out emails to advisors or to our mailing list. I'm like, what suggestions can you make to make this a little bit better? You know, where is there some lack of clarity here? It helps people who are lower or earlier in their sort of craft development story even more to level that up. And I think that's just such a powerful equalizer. And it's going to bring a much richer, more dynamic set of voices to the table. And I don't think there's any drawback for having more people be able to participate in storytelling.
Ethan, it's my understanding that Adaptive Reader isn't the first AI startup that you created. I'm wondering if you can tell us what you learned from your other startup ventures about taking risks and being innovative. And are there any lessons learned from those experiences that you think might be relevant or useful for current Mitchell Scholars?
My first startup wasn't an AI startup, but it provided some of the best lessons for me, maybe some of the most relevant ones for current Mitchell Scholars. I raised some money out of my dorm room my senior year of college to start Palette, which some of you in the audience might have heard of Masterworks.io, which is a business that's around and thriving now and allows you to buy fractional shares of Picasso's and Van Gogh's and these really incredible artworks. And so when those go up in value, your shares in them, just like the stock market, right? Those sort of go up in value as well. So we had that idea a little over a decade ago now, and we tried to build that business and great learning experience that we had the right idea. But we were a decade too early. So timing is so important in these things. And the only thing worse than being late to the game is being too early, which was a really powerful lesson. And the other one is it's just that almost every founder I know that's been successful has failed at one of their startups first. It was such a learning curve. I think of Palette as my free MBA. I learned so much doing that about being an operator, about these very sort of elusive aspects of starting a business. And so I definitely recommend, you know, everyone who's interested in that, going with eyes wide open that this first one that you do might fail and that's a painful thing, but it's not a failure if you're growing as a leader, as a thinker, and it will position you so much better for whatever comes next. Whether that's, you know, that helped me get jobs, that helped me actually transition from that liberal arts major into tech, into product design and product management for software products. So I would say, you know, if you're thinking about it, go out there and talk to other folks who have done it. Maybe think about, and this is something I wish I'd done, maybe think about helping someone else build their dream first, because you can get a paycheck while doing that learning, which is really nice. And you'll learn so much that way too. But yeah, it's a learning journey.
I'm guessing you've built and led teams in the field of AI, and I'm wondering if you can tell us, based on this experience, what do you look for in job applicants? What skills and habits of mind do you find are important for career success in either AI or just in general?
Empathy, curiosity, first and foremost. So I look for thoughtful communicators who are curious about the world. They're interested in what we're trying to do and how that they come to the table with questions. They're wondering, and they're maybe they don't have the perfect match of technical skills or background that I'm looking for. We just had a candidate start last week who, as a growth operation associate, and his background is way off from what you would think you need for that role, but he's so passionate about what we're doing, comes to the table sort of full of curiosity and questions. And I think what's really powerful too, and what's going to be so important in this age of AI, is that he was already experimenting with tools like ChatGPT that can help him level up, be more productive. And it's sort of like this, everyone has a sidekick now that both helps them be better at their job, and can also teach them.
Ethan, how has being a Mitchell Scholar helped you at Harvard and beyond? Were there some ways that the Mitchell Institute's programming or other supports, like the fellowships or the SOS emergency funding, help you during college? Or perhaps did someone at the Mitchell Institute provide you with a career connection or some timely advice?
The Mitchell Institute has just been a fantastic resource all along. When I was applying to colleges, I really didn't know much about these financial aid packages that colleges will give out themselves. And so knowing that there was this fantastic program that could help Mainers put college a little bit more in reach was so powerful. When I became a Mitchell Scholar, I just remember, Jared and Kim and so many of the team members, they took the time to connect with me. They were always open to, answering questions. And there's still people that I circle back to. I circled back to Jared earlier this year, Jared Cash, who's at the Mitchell Institute. And I was like, hey, I'm really looking to connect with school leaders in Maine who can give me feedback on this new educational tool that I'm building. And he just helped facilitate that. And it made such a difference. And looking back a little bit further, I was really lucky to receive a Mitchell Fellowship twice, actually, to as a Mitchell Scholar, it helped me when I was pursuing my career in art to do some sort of non-traditional career exploration during the summer. And then it also helped me in my founder journey, provide some of those critical, really early stage dollars that helped me do some experimentation. So there are so many ways the Mitchell Institute can help. And if there's anything that I've learned, like ask Jared or one of the team members for one of those no agenda coffee chats and just get to know them. And you'll be so surprised at how invested they are in helping.
I'm delighted to hear that the organization has been able to support you in all these ways. Ethan, I'm wondering finally if you can tell us if have there been any pleasant surprises for you about being a Mitchell Scholar?
Yeah, I think the community has definitely been a really pleasant surprise, and it wasn't one that I was anticipating. It shows up in so many different ways. I have been skiing and, met a stranger, found out we were both from Maine, and then somehow, and I don't even know how it came up in conversation, but I was like, oh, we're both Mitchell Scholars. And it was such a great connection. Or I was talking to a curriculum director at the school, and I noticed on her LinkedIn page that she was a Mitchell Scholar. And immediately it just fostered such a sense of shared experience and connection. And there are folks from both the Mitchell Institute and other scholars that have really become part of my community over the years.
Well, Ethan, I want to be mindful of your time, so we'll bring this episode of Scholars Speak to a close. But on behalf of the Mitchell Institute community and scholars and alumni everywhere, I want to thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast today and sharing some of your Mitchell Scholar experience with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks again for joining us for this episode of Scholars Speak. To learn more about the Mitchell Institute, just point your browser to mitchellinstitute.org or follow along on social media on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.